This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to hear what goes on behind the scenes at The Daily Show on Comedy Central. My guest Ben Carlin joined the show as head writer in 1999, shortly after Jon Stewart became the anchor. I know not all of our listeners have cable or get to watch the show, so here's Jon Stewart opening an edition last week.
But right off the top, two pieces of just good news, finally, from the Middle East. In Afghanistan, Abdul Rahman, the man who had faced the death penalty for converting from Islam to Christianity 16 years ago, safe tonight in Italy and in Iraq. Jill Carroll, the American reporter taken hostage 2 months ago, set free. So you see what I'm saying, people? Good news. It's not all bad stuff over there. For every person killed just because of their religion or for being an American, there is another person almost killed. But then at the last minute, not.
That's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. My guest Ben Carlin is now an executive producer of The Daily Show and the spinoff that follows it, The Colbert Report. The Daily Show has won 2 Peabody Awards and 7 Emmys. Carlin also co-wrote Stewart's material for the Oscars broadcast, co-wrote The Daily Show's bestseller, America the Book, and is a former editor of the satirical newspaper The Onion. Ben Carlin, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a report that was about the vice president shooting his friend while hunting. First of all, what went through your mind when you heard the news, knowing that you'd have to come up with some way of addressing this on The Daily Show?
None of us could believe that it actually happened. It's pretty much, in the 8 years or so that I've been at the show, probably the softest ball that has come across the plate, I would say. And there was no shortage of ideas. It was one of those moments where you're sitting in the room with everybody and, you know, there's 20 great things, funny things flying around. And it was just a question of not letting our giddiness overwhelm the process. And, you know, it's nice to let a little bit of that in because it is such a big, meaty, fun subject. But you got to be careful not to, you know, just start laughing just at the mention of what happened, which is we ended up doing a little bit. But that was one of the more fun days, I would say, of the job.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of the report that Nate Cordry did, but I want you to describe the premise of this and how you came up with it.
Well, it was really one of those things where as more details came out, you kind of realized the story was a red herring, because what was most scandalous about the story, in our opinion, as we read reports, was not, you know, what happened between Cheney and Whittington, but actually the fact that the vice president goes on these particular kinds of hunts. The more details were revealed, kind of like deep into the stories as we were reading them, we're just like, wait a second, people go and shoot like 70 caged birds and they're right there and then they're just released. That's not hunting. And we just couldn't get our heads around like what thinking about hunting as this, you know, pursuit which is involved with, has some skill, and you have to go out and you're in the brush all day and you know it's cold and you're up at the crack of dawn and all this ideas that you have about hunting. And we just kind of said, like, this here is really the scandal of this story, that this thing goes on. And is any way, this is the most furthest thing removed from hunting you can possibly imagine. So we said, like, let's actually try to do, this is the closest to, I think, actual journalism. We really go right up to that point. And so we tried to find a place that would let us come on and do one of these hunts.
Well, let's hear the opening of this piece, and then we'll talk more about how you put it together. So here's Nate Cordry on The Daily Show.
When the vice president went on a private hunting trip last month, he took a lot of heat for shooting his friend. But the truth is, he's actually a crack shot who's downed as many as 70 pheasant in a single day. And he's done it on canned hunts, where birds are raised to be shot. I wanted to hunt pheasant like the vice president, so I made a reservation at the Tobacco Stick Hunting Preserve in North Carolina.
We release birds per order of the customer, and the customer is able to go to the field and hunt for these birds.
It's like regular hunting, but with a menu.
Quail are $7 each.
Okay.
The chucker is $13 each. The pheasant is $16. and we used pointing dogs for 75 each.
Can I shoot the dog?
That'd be a very serious issue to shoot the dog.
So I can't shoot?
Can't shoot the dog.
I was pretty sure that the vice president would get to shoot the dog, but 140 pheasant would have to quench my bird lust. But would my $1,000 ensure this was better than regular hunting?
Well, here, the birds are in the field for you. You know they're there. It's a sure thing. The birds are here. Now, on a wild bird hunt, you may find birds and you may not find birds.
And who really has time to hunt and track prey anymore?
It's a sure thing.
One thing I've always hated about hunting, it's a challenge.
So that's an excerpt from The Daily Show of a Nate Cordry report. My guest is Ben Carlin. He's an executive producer of the show, former head writer of the show, been with the show for 8 years. So Ben, explain a little bit more what goes on at this ranch and how the birds are actually shot by the people who've paid to hunt there.
I mean, they're basically kept in a coop, and you walk up and you look at what they have to offer in terms of the menu, and you pick out the amount of birds you want to shoot. And what they do is they take the birds in a crate and they put them in the back of a truck. They drive you and the birds in the back of the truck. So it's like this awkward, dead bird walking moment where you drive to the field. You're in the front seat. The birds are in the back. The guides, if you can call them that, will then take the crates, go out into the brush. They will then dump the bird upside down so it's disoriented into the thicket, okay? You will then get in position, and then the guide will nudge the bird, like roust it basically, and it will, being confused and disoriented, it will attempt to fly, and it flies up and you shoot it. So the one, nanosecond of freedom that this animal, experiences in its life is the nanosecond before it dies, and that's what the vice president does, and we literally could not believe it. We sat there in the editing room and we could not believe that people do this, because truthfully, I went to school in Wisconsin. My roommate was a hunter. I very much like the idea. I don't hunt myself, but I like the idea of it's deer season and you go out. His dad was actually a bow hunter. And would go out every year and bag a couple deer, and we would later on in that year we would eat venison steaks that his dad had shot with a bow and arrow. And I thought that was fairly, in comportment with the order of the universe as we know it. And I don't have any kind of ethical problem with that at all. This to me seemed very cheating.
How did you get permission from this hunting ranch to shoot there? Did they know what you were really up to? Do they know the Daily Show?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think when you go and say we want to do a profile of, your operation, you don't necessarily have to say, and oh, by the way, we're going to belittle it. We don't need to necessarily offer that kind of disclosure. We don't lie about what we're doing and who we are, but we also don't necessarily say, here is the jokes that we're going to tell at your expense. So it's kind of a balance, but we always are truthful to the degree that we don't deny, where we work and who we are and what we're doing.
But with the questions that Nate Cordry asked, they have to assume that either he's a satirist or he's learning disabled.
Yes. Yeah, but I got to tell you, more often than not, it's learning disabled. It's not, people don't, especially when you get into a world that is, fairly esoteric and not necessarily one that's drenched in a lot of exposure to the media or in a media center like New York. I don't think that there's necessarily that same skepticism that what's this person's angle necessarily. We do a fairly good job, better now than we used to, of trying as much as possible to put the onus of stupidity and creepiness on our people.
Mm-hmm.
And not we don't want to make anyone look bad unless they're doing something really horrible. And in this case, these people that we were interviewing weren't, I wouldn't say the perpetrators. They were just people that were working there. So we just kind of used them to kind of get the information out and to kind of make some points in general.
So what was your role in writing that sketch?
Well, in general, what we do is John and myself and David Javerbaum, the head writer, And then, well, Kahani Korn, up until recently, she just went on maternity leave. But we kind of form the core kind of creative nucleus at the top of the show. And the pitches come in. Sometimes the researchers and the field producers and the writers come up with ideas. Sometimes we have ideas and they're put into a packet and we discuss them. And when we identify an idea we really like, the first thing we do is kind of just talk it out. We try to give it a hard test to see if there's a full piece there. And a lot of times that's when some of the best jokes come up, when you're just kind of brainstorming the overall structure of a piece. Once we kind of feel like, okay, we've got a solid idea here, what we'll then do is bring in a producer who will, you know, execute the piece. If it was their idea, then obviously it'll be that person. And then we set about, you know, putting together the elements of it. The researchers will go off and try to find that ranch, the book someone who was willing to talk to us. There's a whole component that involves getting people to these places. So there's a whole huge, you know, component that goes into place in the booking of these things and logistical working out of it. And while that's all happening, we're refining the idea. We're coming up with basically what we call one sheet, which kind of breaks down elements of the story, the characters, you know, what the kind of soul of this opening kind of sentence might be to kind of get you into the piece.
There was something really funny recently set in Daytona Beach. What happened was, you know, Jon Stewart is talking about how Fox News had a report about a serial killer in Daytona Beach who is targeting prostitutes. And Daytona Beach is, of course, one of the places that a lot of students go during spring break, and this was during spring break. So would you take it from here and describe that report?
Yeah. This was something that we have this one department at the show who is kind of the master of all things video that is happening in the world, and they bring us these just beautiful nuggets every now and then. And this was one of the times where they caught this report about a serial killer who was on the loose, who was not targeting college students, was actually targeting prostitutes. However, because it happens to be spring break, the producers of Fox News thought that it would be great in a double box. The split screen, when the reporter was speaking about the serial killer who is on the loose and the three murders have been prostitutes. To put in footage of these just dancing, drinking, you know, women, of course, in bikinis, doing, you know, faux striptease dances on stages and on the beach, kind of MTV spring break style. And so you have this reporter giving this deadly serious report about a serial killer, and this just completely gratuitous, in no way relevant to the story, footage in the other box. Distracting and more than distracting, completely. I mean, I would imagine, was just felt ashamed that this is what they chose to run in there. And then they go to this police expert who's talking about prevention and talking about things that you can do and when something like that is happening. And they just continue, you know. And it's not just shots like a wide shot. They're showing like up close shots of cleavage and jiggling butts and everything. And it went on for about a minute and a half.
So are there people on the staff of The Daily Show whose job it is to just, like, monitor TV news and look for the most absurd things going on?
Yeah. That's we call them studio production, post-production. It's a group of guys led by someone named Rory Albanese, who's just incredible. And they will find these things. And in the morning when we have our morning writers meeting, they'll come in and say, look at this great thing we saw on Fox, or check this out. This was the other night we had this footage from C-SPAN of Les Kinsolving, a Baltimore radio personality who was on camera, unfortunately, during the White House press conference while the person next to him was asking a question. And he decided at that point it was the time to dig in and bite, a hangnail that had really been bothering him. And he spent a solid 10, 15 seconds on camera, like basically eating his nail. And then just when you think it couldn't get much worse, he then like kind of reaches into his mouth and like takes it out and flicks it. And they caught this and brought it to us. And that's our equivalent of manna.
I know another thing that you often do on The Daily Show is take clips from past interviews or past press conferences that completely contradict what that same person has just said and play them back to back. So you take a current clip of somebody in the news, often somebody in the Bush administration, and juxtapose that with a clip of them saying exactly the opposite thing weeks or months ago. And I'll play an example of that. And this is, I think this is called Bush versus Bush. And it's President Bush from the time when he was governor and campaigning for the presidency, juxtaposed with what President Bush has said about Iraq. So let's hear a short clip of this.
Mr. President, you won the coin toss. The first question will go to you. Why is the United States of America using its power to change governments in foreign countries?
We must stand up for our security and for the permanent rights and the hopes of mankind. The United States of America will make that stand.
Well, certainly that represents a bold new doctrine in foreign policy, Mr. President. Governor Bush, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm not so sure the role of the United States is to go around the world and say this is the way it's got to be.
All right. Well, that's interesting. That's a difference of opinion, and certainly that's what this country is about. Differences of opinion. Mr. President, let me just get specific. Why are we in Iraq?
We will be changing the regime of Iraq for the good of the Iraqi people.
Governor, then I'd like to hear your response on that.
If we're an arrogant nation, they'll resent us. I think one way for us to end up being viewed as the ugly American is for us to go around the world saying, we do it this way, so should you.
Well, that's an excellent point. I don't think you can argue with that. Mr. President, is the idea to just build a new country that we like better?
We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you to build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free. I don't think our troops ought to be used for what's called nation building.
Well, that's fair enough, Governor.
It's an excerpt from The Daily Show. My guest is Ben Carlin, who is an executive producer and former head writer of the show. So Ben, do you remember how the sketch was written and what the process was like of finding the juxtaposed footage of the president?
Yeah. I mean, again, most things start with kind of just a concept or an idea. And this was kind of born out of this idea that everyone is saying so-and-so is a flip-flopper or this person is not consistent, and that's a label that people always tried, especially in last couple elections that people put on that was a very strong tactic that Republicans used against Democrats. And we always, you know, believed that you are it's very difficult to be 100% consistent all the time, especially when cameras are always going to be on you. You're always going to be caught one way or the other. And we felt very strongly that Bush had kind of gotten this relatively free ride on this whole idea that he himself hadn't changed positions pretty radically on several things. So the idea then becomes to find the best examples to animate that. The challenge there more than anything is to try to make them funny. You know, before you want to make a point, but you got to really be very careful not to kind of dip into being super didactic. So I think for us, it was about finding the balance of making the point, which we thought was a valid point, but also injecting enough humor into it in the way that it was edited and structured, so people didn't feel like they were being, you know, poked in the chest.
Now, you've said that there are things in which where you think that the straight press has given a free ride to people in the administration or in Congress. How do you see the role of The Daily Show as a kind of adjunct to the press?
By definition, we exist as a reaction to the press in terms of commenting off of what they are doing or what they're not doing. But as far as like a defined role, we really try not to get into that too much, only because of the desire and the need to just produce something funny every day. And the kind of what it means or what are we doing exactly doesn't really come into it like that philosophically, I would have to say. When you study it or not study it, but when you look back and say, oh, this was this or this was that, then you kind of can say, oh, well, we were actually being a commentator in the same way that an editorial cartoon would be a comment on the day's news. But I don't think we necessarily ever start a meeting by saying, okay, well, here's what the press is doing. Here's what they're not doing. Let's do this. That just can't enter into our process, just mainly because of efficiency. It just wouldn't work to add that added level of mission.
Are there a mix of like liberal and conservative writers on The Daily Show?
I don't think it'd be fair to say that there's a very strong, whether you want to call it conservative or Republican voice on the show. If anything, it's probably streaked more with more of a libertarian take. I mean, the idea of liberal is such a weird designation at this point because if you're thinking about kind of old guard 60s idealist kind of, you know, utopian type thing, I don't really think a lot of us believe that anymore. I do think that when you think about libertarian, you know, ideas of individual freedom and, you know, the government not really getting too involved in your life for better and worse, I think that kind of probably is the strongest strain throughout the staff.
Now, one of the regular features on The Daily Show, or irregular features, is called Great Moments in Punditry, in which you basically have two children reading transcripts of pundits slinging mud at each other. And before we hear an excerpt of that, how did you come up with this idea?
Sometimes necessity being the mother of invention, you know, the show is very monolithic in terms of the field pieces are 3 or 4 minutes and the headlines sections of the show tend to be, you know, 3 or 4 minutes long and the interviews, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. And what we really need on the show are shorter pieces, a minute long, you can put in or take out based on how heavy or light the show is on that particular day. So we, you know, spend a lot of time trying to think of ideas that kind of lend themselves to short treatment. And one of the things that we really noticed in watching so much punditry is that it really devolves very quickly into this kind of zero-sum game of I saying this, you saying this, and I'm the liberal and you're the conservative, and the host says, okay, thanks a lot. That was a productive conversation, and you're nowhere further or closer to any kind of truth or understanding. So when you just think about that, we just think, well, that's just children saying nanny, nanny, nanny. So why don't we get actual children and read these transcripts?
Well, let's hear an excerpt of Great Moments in Punditry from The Daily Show. So again, it's two children reading a transcript of two pundits speaking, and the pundits who are being read in this case are conservative radio and TV talk show host Sean Hannity and radio talk show host John Sylvester.
If they have a different view than yours, why do you belittle them? Why do you demean them? Why do you insult them and use incendiary language, except to help yourself and your failing ratings because you're not doing particularly well?
Well, you know, that's funny, because you had much lower ratings. That's why I took you off my station, all right? You know what? You're pathetic.
I'm on 500 stations. You are on one.
You are pathetic. You are pathetic.
You don't do very well, do you?
You are pathetic.
That's an example of Great Moments in Punditry from The Daily Show, and my guest is Ben Carlin, an executive producer of The Daily Show and of The Colbert Report. Well, you know, there's a famous television moment where Jon Stewart was on Crossfire with Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala, and he basically begged them to stop hurting America. And he said to them, the thing is, you're doing theater when you should be doing debate. He said, it's not honest. What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And this ended up on the internet, and the website, I saw it on. I went back to the website last night. There's already been like over 3 million hits just on this one website that has the clip. You were with him, I think, at CNN.
We were down in Washington. Uh-huh. We'd done a book event earlier in the day and had gone over. And it was actually something that, in our private moments, John, DJ, and myself would talk a lot about how great it would be to just call those guys out on what they do. But it was always this thing that was talked about in the laboratory of our private sanctum. And then when it was brought out into the into the world, while people responded to it in a positive way, I don't think that John, I know that John did not feel great about the way that all went down. And being in the room while it was happening, I can tell you, was probably the most awkward thing that I've ever kind of witnessed, because, you know, it was real. It was, you know, there's this kind of veneer that everyone puts on when you go on television. And this was someone, you know, just being unbelievably painfully honest to people's faces. And it was there was just a you could just feel the air just being sucked right out of the room.
Well, what kind of thought went into it beforehand? Did you and John Stewart sit down and say, here's what you can do to lampoon the crossfire type of debate?
No, because that wasn't a lampoon. That's the difference. I mean, that was just a naked reprobation. And I think that we had always just talked about that as what would happen if you just went on there and just refused to play their game. And it was something that, you know, even in the car ride on the way over there, we talked about it. And it was there was considerable, you know, back and forth. Should I do this? Should we do this? Is this, you know. And we didn't know how it was going to go. And we thought that maybe, well, that could be just one small part of the conversation. Maybe say something either at the top or at the bottom, and then just the rest of the show will be the rest of the show. What was not foreseen was that it became, you know, the whole show. And then certainly afterwards, when we were – the conversation continued for about an hour afterwards, you know, back in the green room. And then the president of CNN was in there, I think, or the head of programming at the time, and it was fairly heated afterwards as well, and we just felt going back to the hotel that that was just a disaster of the highest order, and we had no idea that it would then become this thing that would, you know, have a life on its own.
So were you in the audience when this was happening? Could Jon Stewart see your face?
Well, I was in this instead of standing backstage, I wanted to watch it from the auditorium. So I was kind of in the back of the auditorium watching it with a producer, and you know the lights are down, so I don't think he could see me because I was standing way in the back.
Thinking, "Oh no."
Well, it was awkward because I was standing next to the producer of Crossfire, or one of the producers.
Oh.
And I just
kind
of
was at,
in the commercial break, I was just like, this is going well.
When the cartoon riots happened, was that a really sobering thing to you to see how like some satires can actually end in riots and people killed and death threats?
Not really. I mean, it was an extreme and incredible example, but it wasn't something that was that implausible given, you know, the kind of growing tension that has just, you know, been out there for the last several years. And whether it's been a stated thing or an unintended byproduct, you know, it's become very clear that the way certain elements of the Muslim world see the West or the U.S. and whatever you want to call it, you know, that is a real tension that, you know, some people exploit, some people try to downplay, but it's there. But as far as This Week in God goes, for us, it's an example of, you know, I think 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it was very difficult, even on basic cable, to do a lot of jokes about religion, especially, you know, South Park can get away with it because it's under the guise of being animated. But when you have real people talking about religion, that is the one thing that lights up the phone boards. You know, people really don't have a sense of humor about their own faith, or many people don't, I should say. Ironically, Stephen Colbert, who originated the segment, is quite religious himself and somehow has this magic gene that allows him to retain, you know, his faith and retain his, you know, relationship with God and his religion and still, you know, make jokes, because I think he can see the absurdity through what's happening.
No, you and Jon Stewart are both Jewish, and Stewart sometimes uses the word Jewy on the show.
Yes.
Only a Jewish person could get away with doing that.
That is very true. That is very true. It's very funny, though, because a lot of times we'll write the other night we did one where Samantha Bee, who's not Jewish, mm-hmm. was in Israel reporting on the reporting on the Israeli election results. And that's so in our kind of Jew wheelhouse in terms of, you know, where we go for humor on that subject. And we had five or six jokes that really could only be written by Jewish people. You know, I think we were talking about the number of parties, and there's 12 parties, and we were listing off some of the lesser known parties, and one of them was the Chutzpahkrats, and another one was Lefkowitz Party of Four.
Yeah, that's right. It was really funny.
And to have a non-Jew, I mean, have to recite those words, it's very funny to see. And every now and then we'll put in Yiddish. We'll put in a little Yiddish. I think someone called her, she said that she was being called a shiksa. And to see someone who isn't just familiar with that kind of language and that kind of speech pattern have to say these words, it's really not it's not fair.
So what's the consensus among your Jewish viewers? Is The Daily Show good for the Jews or bad for the Jews?
I have no idea. I think it's probably in the tradition of Jews who are ambivalent or hesitant to really embrace their religion, but very much want to acknowledge it.
Now, you started your career at the satirical newspaper The Onion. Did you ever write news for real before writing satirical news?
Yeah, I did. I was a feature writer for a couple papers in Madison, Wisconsin. I mainly did arts coverage, stories about bands and movie reviews and play reviews. And I also did some sports writing as well, because I went to the University of Wisconsin. So I covered the University of Wisconsin as a freelance journalist for a couple of smaller papers in the state of Wisconsin, the La Crosse Tribune being one of them.
So how did you start working on The Onion?
I was in college, and I was writing for the newspaper, one of the student dailies. There were two. And a bunch of writers from the paper I was working for, which was the Daily Cardinal, had migrated from the Cardinal to the Onion. And the Onion was still very young and new on campus and was kind of becoming more and more popular. And it just seemed like such a more fun place to work. And you could kind of apply what little you did know at age 21 about journalism in a far more creative environment. So once I kind of got a little bored with writing for the Cardinal, I contacted the guys over at The Onion, and they had me submit, and I joined as just an idea contributor and a writer my senior year of college.
What are some of the favorite headlines that you generated during your years with The Onion?
Well, my favorite was Christ Returns to the NBA. And that was done after Michael Jordan returned to the NBA. And we had this great photo on the cover, which was Jesus just viciously dunking over a bunch of players with this just horrible look on his face. You got a guy who looked like Jesus. And the great thing about that story was, as I wrote it, we put in all these details that Jesus actually in college wasn't really that good of a basketball player. Like, he was second team all conference and he scored 19 points a game. Like, we had all these great little details that kind of undercut this idea of Jesus being this omnipotent being. That was probably one of my favorites, just because the picture is so unbelievably dramatic.
And what was another?
Another was probably... keeping on the religion theme, I did a story called "Jews to Release Box Set."
What was that?
And it was the Jewish people were going to try to summarize their 10,000-year existence in a 6-CD set that included a picture book of some of the highlights of their existence in the history of man.
So, was writing for The Onion a good preparation for The Daily Show?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, The Onion, writing for The Onion was just good preparation for writing comedy in general, because, you know, The Onion is such a strict format and such a strict voice, and you kind of learn that structure gives you freedom. You know, you kind of know the limitations, so you have to make something funny within the limitations of this news voice. And you have some options, because we do, you know, we used to do a lot of character pieces. So if you had an idea for... you know, for something that was more in the first person voice, there was, not, you know, you could write it in the form of an editorial, or if you had something that was truly conceptual, like one of my favorite things we used to do, which I think they still do every now and then, is writing these segments which were ask and then you fill in whatever the funny thing is. So the first time I saw it, I didn't write the one that really got me loving this segment, but the first one I saw, I came back from vacation, and some of the stories were already pasted up on the paste-up boards because this was back in the day before true desktop publishing. So the story was ask, I think it was called Ask a Jazzman or Ask Scat, I believe. And it was so it was a typical advice column. So someone writes in and says, you know, my wife and I have been having some problems, blah, blah, blah. And it's just a typical kind of advice question. And then the answer was done entirely in scat. Zibbity, bitty, bitty, boo, bitty, boo, like the whole thing. And so it was coming up with things like that and breaking out of the news format but still finding a home for it in a newspaper really kind of teaches you that, you know, like no creative challenge really can't be met.
So do you end the day by actually watching The Daily Show and The Colbert Report at home on TV?
No, definitely not.
Why not?
There is not. That's one of the most amazing things. And if it was true about Larry Sanders, the idea of the host or the people who are involved in the production of the show actually going home and watching the show on air that night after 5 hours earlier watching it being taped is I can't imagine doing that. The last thing I want to do when I leave the studio is to revisit. Not that it's unpleasant, but just because you just need that separation. You just need that. If you're leaving at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock at night, and you know you're coming back in the next morning at 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, the last thing you want to do at 11:30 is to watch the show again. If every now and then, if there's something amazing that happened and I want to show it to a friend or something like that, I'll, you know, and I'm with them, I'll do that. But I absolutely do not make a practice of watching the show at home.
Ben Carlin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ben Carlin is an executive producer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and The Colbert Report. If you want to see videos from The Daily Show, you can find a link on our website, freshair.npr.org.